Centrally Speaking is the Central Schwenkfelder Church's podcast. It speaks about issues that would be of interest to our society. In particular, it addresses how a Christian worldview intersects with Western secular culture. In the spirit of the church's founder, we take the perspective of the middle way, which is in agreement with the historic Christian church.
I'm Dr. Drake Williams, Minister of Mission and Theology at the Church. Our website is www.cscfamily.org. Our topic today is preservation and the Schwenkfelder culture. And we're very fortunate to be joined by Beth Twiss Howding, who's the new director at the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center in Pennsburg, Pennsylvania. Beth has 30 years of experience in the museum world. Before coming to the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center, she was the Senior Director of Program Services at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. There, she also had a specialty in visitor research. She holds a master's degree in American Material Culture from the Winitor Program from the University of Delaware, and she has a certificate in museum management. And besides these professional accomplishments, she and her husband maintain a home from the 1800s. So, Beth, we're very glad that you're with us today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
I wonder if you could talk to us first about how you became involved in museum work. How did you first take an interest in this field, and why have you devoted some 30 years to this type of work?
It actually is truly a lifelong interest. As a child, I was taken to a lot of historic sites. I always loved history in school. And when I was exploring colleges and careers, I learned that you could actually work in a museum, not just visit them. And it was like a light bulb went off. And so it's really been my life's calling in a way. I believe that museums are very important civic and educational institutions that we need to be preserving our history, both for an individual and for a community purpose, and that they help us to be better people and better citizens.
Can you explain to us more about the Library and Heritage Center, that it's more than just a library and that there are other activities that are happening there?
Sure. Our name is a bit of a mystery to people. When we say Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center, you know, what is a Schwenkfelder? Is this only for Schwenkfelders? And is this a public library? And what happens at a heritage center? So to unpack all of that, first of all, it's open to anyone and everyone. While we deal a lot with Schwenkfelder history and have things in our library and in our museum collection that were owned by Schwenkfelders, we also look at the broader community, Upper Perkiomen region, Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. So anyone can come here. They can come tour exhibits. They can come to programs. We have a very active program for children, for instance, learning history or exploring history. And then in the library, people can come to do research, whether it's about their family, genealogy. It can be about their own property and homes. We have a lot of materials that are helpful for people doing house research, general local history research. One of the things that I personally have found interesting is the fact that we have records for all the churches in the area, not just the Schwenkfelder churches. So it really is a center that's open to the public and for a much more general public than the name may originally sound.
What specifically makes this a value for the surrounding area, and why specifically preserve this type of culture?
Well, it has two aspects to it. One is the specific culture, the preservation of the Schwenkfelder heritage. So the center is important for being the one place that does that, brings together the history of the religion along with the history of the life of the people. And the life of the people brings us to that other aspect, which is preserving what life was like in the Upper Perkiomen Valley. I think that all history is local. The way people say all politics is local, I think all history is local. That we begin with interest in that which is closest to us, whether it's our family history or our town history, and that it is from that basis we move to being interested in national and international history. So therefore, to me, this kind of institution is particularly important because it's serving people, connecting to their roots. It's family history for Schwenkfelders, it's church history for the people who go to those congregations, and its history of this geographic region.
What do you think makes a culture want to preserve itself? There are obviously all sorts of, whether it be neighborhoods or groupings, that never get around to wanting to preserve itself. But what aspects make a culture particularly interested in having a legacy that people will visit or be handed down from year to year?
I think it's probably a very human trait. rooted in desire for legacy, the word you used, and for immortality. And if we look back at cultures like the Egyptians or American Indians who were burying themselves with items of everyday life, you know, they were preserving their culture at that moment as well. So I think it's really a sense of saying we were here, we mattered, what we did was worthwhile, and this is a way in which we can continue to remember that and to grow on it.
When you come to the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center, it's a relatively small group, though, that banded together to preserve its culture. Are there any distinctives about such a small culture, a small community wanting to do this that stand out to you?
Yeah, I've been really interested in that question since I first learned of this place and then took this job, because there is a great passion among people involved with the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center in that preservation that you speak of. And it probably is born of a group shared experience in persecution and immigration. And you see that even now with other immigrant groups that come to this country. It's not even usually the first couple generations. They're getting established. And I think that was probably true for the Schwenkfelders too. But then as time goes on, there's a need to remember and to identify with the experiences of those earlier, of those ancestors, of what went on. And I think that's part of it, a sense of saying what happened to us was special to who we are today, and our experience is also something that we'd like to share with the world.
And there are a lot of stories I know at the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center of how people preserve, whether it be artwork or literature, and went to great sacrifices to be able to put together something like the Corpus Schwenkfeldianorum, the 19 volume set of Caspar Schwenkfeld's writings, and to then bring them to the Heritage Center as a place then to study and to preserve that that literature. But there's an, I guess, another aspect to preservation of culture too, and that somebody has to preserve it. And when it comes to a museum curator, I'm sure you get all sorts of things that people want to preserve, some things of value, some things not of value. How do you sort this out? What do you say, thank you, it's nice that you brought this to us, but we don't have a spot for it. Or maybe you have to go looking for something, maybe something like Schwenkfeld's Bible, which all of a sudden just came out of nowhere, and we certainly would want to preserve that. What goes through your mind as a curator of these things?
Well, museums have various particular procedures, I guess you'd say, or policies for doing that. The first thing is to have a mission. It clearly says, why do we exist? And then from that, to develop what's known as a collection management policy, and in that is the scope of collections. So what are the things that we want to collect that are going to allow us to meet that mission? If you look at the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center, for instance, our mission references that we're going to tell the stories of Schwenkfelders and Pennsylvania Germans of the Perkiomen region. So right away, that begins to narrow. Somebody brings us something from, I don't know, Pittsburgh, and it's not related to a Schwenkfelder, then it falls outside the scope of collection. Now, of course, it's still pretty broad. It means you can get a lot of Schwenkfelder household furnishings, and you may not need to exhibit all of them or preserve all of them. And then it gets into issues of, is there something about that that's particularly unique? Is it related to a particular person who's important within Schwenkfelder history? Is it a particularly beautiful or well-made example of something? So it doesn't narrow the field as much as might be helpful sometimes, but it certainly does begin to do that by following back on one's mission and scope of collections.
Well, you talked about certain pieces that might be preserved. One of them was furniture. What makes furniture of value for the preservation of a culture and its heritage?
Or as somebody who studied that exactly in graduate school, material culture, I have a very strong feeling about that. And it's many layered, I guess you'd say. First of all, you can't know everything about a culture just from the material objects that remain, but it's a wonderful complement to written materials, because there are things that you can learn from a physical object that you may not be able to learn from a book. So to take furniture as an example, let's say some chairs and tables. You can have books that show what was fashionable at a particular time, what was considered unusual or the best versions of something, but they may never have been made, or they may not have been bought and used in the homes of Schwenkfelders. And so having the actual chairs and tables shows us what people actually had. And from those, we can determine other things, like the woods are, that things are made up, tell us geographically where they're made, or the way in which something was done can get us back to sometimes a common craftsperson. And then we can learn about that particular person's role within a community. A chair, you know, if you were to sit on it, you might suddenly discover that you had to have a certain kind of posture. So you begin to feel what it might be like to live there. I think there's a, let's say, a certain emotional or imaginary piece of this when we're with material objects that it, some writers call it magical thinking, that you can transport yourself back in time. If you go into an old house or you're looking or sitting in old tables and chairs, what it would have been like to actually have lived at those times.
Let's talk a little bit more about what could be contained or viewed in furniture. You said so that you can imagine what took place in the past. Is there anything about, let's say, the ways that furniture might be crafted that reveals something about the values of the people who did that type of crafting?
That can be a little tricky, but we, again, complementing it sometimes with written materials like account books and other kinds of materials, we can get a sense of that. For instance, there was a German tradition in making Windsor chairs that when you inserted the leg through the seat, that a wedge would be pounded in to what's really the top of the leg as it comes through the seat. That makes it stronger, makes it last longer. We might extrapolate from that. There's an interest in longevity and frugality in the values of the people who do that, because not all people, all cultures made things that way. We would, of course, want to, as they say, look for other sources to see if that plays out. In looking at, let's say, tall case clocks, we have a lot of tall case clocks. The ways in which they're decorated can tell us what kinds of values sometimes people have. So something that becomes popular on clocks in the early 1800s is to have inlay on the doors or carving at the top that represent eagles. So therefore showing an interest in the greater nationalism of the United States, not just an interest in one's own community. So things like that can be signs of a larger group identity and value system.
My guess is it could probably reveal frugality or ingenuity.
Certainly with Pennsylvania Germans, an aesthetic that is very colorful, that relies a lot on different images of what we might today call folk images of birds and trees and that kind of thing that can be traced back to Europe.
Literature certainly tells us a lot about a culture too, what's valuable, what's preserved. I find these things intriguing that, as you said, you have history, but you also have faith history interwoven. Can you speak about some of the documents that you have there at the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center that are maybe just historical pieces as well as faith-based pieces too?
Well, you already mentioned Schwenkfeld's Bible. This being, for those who don't know, the Bible that he owned and which he annotated. So certainly for church history, that's essential to see the evolution of his thought, his interpretation of particular verses in the scripture. We also have a number of what were called postilles or compilations of sermons. These were not necessarily written down by the person who gave the sermon, but copied by people to take with them for home study and to share, and we have those over a period of over 100 years. So that shows you a tradition as well as an evolution in a faith. Another large collection we have are of hymns, the early ones being manuscripts of specific hymns, and then starting in 1762, the publication of a Schwenkfelder hymnal. And one of the interesting things about those is it shows us that the Schwenkfelders were part of a larger Protestant Reformation movement that were sharing the same ways to celebrate and express their faith. And we don't know of very many that were specifically written by Schwenkfelders, but there are a couple in the 1762 first hymnal, which seemed to be. So it both shows perhaps particular individual ways of worshiping, but also how it fits within a larger community.
Great. Might you say something about the artwork that's preserved there? I know there are fractures and other pieces. Can you share about a piece or two that's striking?
Sure. So fractur, for those who've not seen that, is an old tradition, German tradition, of illuminating or creating artwork on other kinds of materials. We think about illuminated manuscripts and Bibles from the Middle Ages, for instance, where the first letter of a line is very fanciful and there might be these little drawings around. With Fraktur, it tended to be on certificates, whether it was a marriage and death certificate, so life events, or often a certificate that a schoolmaster made to give to a school child. And we do have hundreds of them here. They certainly speak to the aesthetic of color and pattern in the Schwenkfelder heritage. One of the interesting things about these is that there were people within a community who were the scriveners, who were the people who created these. And so in a collection like ours, you can begin to sort of put together Fraktur from certain hands. I find that really interesting. And those people then, in some cases, use those skills in other ways. So we have a what we would call a blanket chest that has an inscription of a name and a date on it, and we can match that with a Fraktur illuminator. So I find that really fascinating. The other is that school children were not all going to be grow up to become Fraktur, you know, artists, but that they were taught some of the similar ways of script and drawing. And right now we have out on display, for instance, a large collection of drawings that children made in school as they practiced this art over time. As you can imagine, some are more faithful to the original and some are quite fanciful.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure. Can you share any, let's say, Christian representations in the Fraktur's at all? Designs that...
I'm not an expert on this. I know that in some cases there are references to Bible stories or scriptures. It's not something that I think the average person looking at the Fraktur is going to pick up the allusion right away, but those who study it can point out for us, oh, this is X, Y, or Z. They also pull upon other folk tales too. So it mixes the two together in an interesting way.
I know there's also a lot of German literature and German background at the Library and Heritage Center of some of the literature that you have. Maybe you have a rough estimate of the percentage that is German?
I'm afraid I don't know that percentage. We're really, really fortunate to have as our Associate Director of Research, Dr. Alan Biemeyer, because he can read German and the old German. I mean, part of it too, German, the language, the script has evolved. So just being able to read German doesn't necessarily make it all accessible to us. And there's much yet to be translated.
Is there anything you'd like to add about the Christian roots of the materials preserved at the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center?
Well, I think the kinds of things we were talking about in the library and the archives are, you know, clearly related to the development of Reformation Protestantism, and that show us how people were struggling in the early years, in the early 1500s, to think about how to interpret the Bible, how to live a faithful life, and that one of the great things about the wealth and the breadth of our collection is that you can see how that thinking evolves, even within a single person, but certainly over time, as people are influenced by others, as they have new epiphanies, as they react to the time in which they live.
Beth, can you share a little bit about some of the more unusual items that are found at the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center?
Of course, I'm coming in at a really exciting time here where I can take no credit for making it happen, but I can enjoy the expansion of the center to include two galleries devoted to rural life and entrepreneurship, and then a reconstructed 1826 barn. And I've had great fun in the last couple months getting to explore these things. And so in terms of farm life, there are things that, you know, I didn't know what they were. There are these whole panel of these objects that are kind of the size of a finger, but made out of different materials. And it turns out they're for shucking corn, something you would put on your hand and go to a corn shucking bee and all sit around and take the corn off the cob. There's probably the largest, most unusual object is this wooden screw that must be probably 18 inches in diameter and is so tall that it has to stand at an angle in a room whose ceiling already is like 10 feet tall. And that turns out to be a screw from a cider mill. I kind of went down the rabbit hole of research last week to find out if it's from the apple mill, where they were squishing the apples up before they put them into the press to make cider.
Well, do you want to say something about the barn that you've just put up?
as someone whose most specific interest is in architectural history, I love the barn. And so I've been really enjoying, in particular, getting to know the Sipe family and learning their experiences with this barn that came from their family farm. This barn was built in 1826. The Schwenkfelder connection here is it was given to us by a Schwenkfelder family. It was built by a Mennonite family, but they bought the land from Schwenkfelder family back in around 1800. So this barn was built in 1826. It was used up through the middle of the 1900s. Over time, of course, it altered as farming methods altered. It was primarily used for livestock, cows to be fed and milked, and then for the storage of grains. It no longer was being used, and the Sipe family generously donated it to the center. It was taken down piece by piece and then reconstructed here on our site. The more modern pieces of it, such as silos, were not brought. This is taking it back to 1826. And we were really fortunate to have a very sensitive building crew, the Quarry View Building Group out of Lancaster County, who do a lot of barn work, to work with us on this project. And they were able to help, for instance, reconstruct what the original milking stalls would have looked like based on a lot of research and experience they have from working with old barns. My favorite story, though, about the barn is that the second level, overlooking what we call the front of the barn, the forebay, there's a window or a small door. Fred Sipe tells a story about a horse that had come into the second story of the barn, because it's a bank barn, and had come in and backed out the window and landed on the ground in front of the barn, like 12 feet below, and wasn't hurt.
Amazing that it could fall that far. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you might answer one other question. Is just someone who's been involved in the museum world and preservation for so long. We seem to be a culture that is speeding up with our cell phones and our emails and internet connections. I'm curious if you might have something to say about the way that we forget as a culture and the importance of trying to remember.
Well, I think there are two kinds of forgetting. One is what you're probably talking about is not conscious. It happens because we're busy living our lives and we forget to write things down or to save things. I was just recently talking with my mother-in-law, who's made a real effort to keep a diary every day of the pandemic. And that's something I, who am interested in history, have not done. And I was really impressed. There's also a conscious way of forgetting in what do we preserve and what don't we preserve. And I think, you know, right now at this time in our nation, we can see some of that coming into play in community conversations about where am I in the history. So there are two kinds of forgetting, and we have to think about both of them. On the individual basis, I think it really is important to think about the fact that while our lives, for most of us, are pretty mundane and seem ordinary, they won't in 200 years. So whether it's how we dress or how we furnish our home or how we worship in our church, all of those have value in being saved.
Beth, is there anything else that you'd like to say about the Schwenkfelder Library and Heritage Center?
Of course, I would like to invite people to come see us, visit us, use us. The Library and Heritage Center is open now. Our hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 2 currently. As the public health situation changes and hopefully improves, we will be expanding our hours. So people should always check out our website, www.schwenkfelder.com, to check on the hours. If you want to do research in the library, that you can call ahead or email ahead, and we will make an appointment for you to come in and do that right now. We are very conscious about taking people's health concerns into account, but we're here and we're doing a lot of programming, on-site programming, with social distance, but we also have a lot of virtual programming, particularly for children. So check out our website to see our hours, how to make a reservation for research, and to reserve a program.
Well, this is good. Thank you so much for answering these questions. Thank you for listening to Centrally Speaking. We're pleased that you joined us for this conversation today, and we invite you to listen in to other conversations that we'll have in the coming weeks. Of course, you're always welcome at the Central Schwenkfelder Church. We meet on Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock in the morning outside, at 9 o'clock for a traditional service in the sanctuary, and then a contemporary service at 10:45. We also offer a Zoom Sunday school class meeting at 10:30 each Sunday morning as well. As the situation with the pandemic changes, once again, consult our website, www.cscfamily.org, for times and also for services. Of course, we warmly invite you to join us.